You're listening to Knowledge at Wharton on Business Radio. Here again is Dan Loney.
Welcome back. Hour number two of Knowledge at Wharton here on Sirius XM 132. Business Radio powered by the Wharton School. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. It is the 11th of July. Great having you joining us wherever you're listening around the United States or up into Canada or, as we found out earlier in the show, in the Bahamas as well. Coming up here in the second hour of our show, in just a minute, we'll have our number of the day. And then we're going to talk about infrastructure in the state of California, which again was tested by the fact that there were a couple of earthquakes last week. Obviously, the state of California has had to deal with numerous earthquakes over the last few hundred years, and it has really tested the infrastructure piece in that state. But how have they been able to develop better infrastructure in understanding that earthquakes are somewhat of a normal course of doing business in that state? We'll talk about it coming up in just a second. And then in our final 30, Kim Kardashian West going through the process of renaming her clothing brand. It had been titled Kimono, but many people taking offense to it because of its importance in Japanese culture. We'll discuss what is next for her and her brand. Talk about that coming up at 11:30 Eastern Time. All of that in the second hour of our show. The way for you to join in is either by phone at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866, or if you'd like, you can send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account at DanLoney21. First, though, our number of the day, and it is 95. IBM, well-known company, says it receives more than 8,000 resumes a day, which makes it number one on job search site Glassdoor for Gen Z applicants. That, according to IBM CEO Gina Rometty, who made that comment at CNBC's recent Work Talent and HR Summit in New York City earlier this week. But that's not the only way that the tech giant, which employs roughly 350,000 workers, knows who in the workforce is currently searching for a new position. IBM's artificial intelligence technology is now, according to the company, 95% accurate in predicting workers who are planning to leave their jobs. During Rometty's tenure as CEO, IBM has been working to improve its AI devoted to the retention of its employees. Rometty says, quote, "The best time to get an employee is before they go." Again, IBM's artificial intelligence says it can predict with 95% accuracy which workers are about to quit their jobs. 95, our number of the day. Twin earthquakes that hit California last week were among the strongest in two decades, yet they caused little damage and no loss of life. This was in large part because the epicenter was in a more remote part of the state. Still, they have caused experts to look at how prepared they are should a similar seismic event take place in a more populated area like Los Angeles or San Francisco. And while some buildings in cities like that have been required to be strengthened, many others, particularly brick structures, remain vulnerable. Looking back at the 1989 quake near San Francisco that caused major damage to bridges and roads and took years to repair. So what more should California do to secure its infrastructure against large earthquakes like the ones we just saw? Jonathan Stewart is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UCLA. He joins us. He will be joining us in just a second. Mary Comerio is a professor of the graduate school at the University of California at Berkeley in their Department of Architecture, and she joins us right now. Mary, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great to have you with us. So give us a sense of your belief of how well prepared California is from an infrastructure perspective for these earthquakes.
Well, California has done a great deal since Loma Prieta and Northridge. Caltrans has invested millions in retrofitting bridges and freeway overpasses all across the state. Many of our water systems, the Hetch Hetchy water system in East Bay Mud in the Bay Area, and LA Water and Power, they've all retrofitted their trunk lines, bringing water from the Sierras, and they are slowly upgrading the pipes that, you know, distribute the water. So these are really positive things that has happened in the state, and there are others. BART passed a bond. The Bay Area Rapid Transit passed a bond to retrofit its tracks and some of the stations. So there's been work done, but it isn't enough. You know, it's 30 years worth of work, and it's important. It will make a difference in future quakes, but there's still much, much more to be done.
John Stewart joining us from UCLA. John, how do you view the job that California has done in recent years in preparing the state and its infrastructure?
I would echo what Mary said. I think we are making very positive steps on a number of fronts, but if the question is, are we ready? We're not ready. The trajectory is going in the right direction. One area that I think we've made a good deal of progress is with our bridges. We had significant bridge collapses for highways in the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, 1994 Northridge earthquake, and this prompted the state to undertake an aggressive retrofit and, in some cases, replacement program to harden the bridge infrastructure, which is important every day and especially important in an emergency response situation.
I would imagine. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
Well, and that program has largely been completed for the state-owned highway bridges.
I would imagine that there has had to be a level of innovation in this as well, John, to be able to make the necessary changes so that you don't have the extensive damage like you saw back in 1989 with Loma Prieta.
Yeah, there has been innovation. In fact, this is a direct use of university research for the public good. Many of the bridges were retrofitted with wrapping of columns that support the bridge, and the applicability and the limits and just how to apply those techniques were developed in University of California research.
Is there an element, Mary, though, you can reach a certain point and then to a degree maybe you have gone as far as you can go? And I say that in referencing what we said at the top. You can make changes to newer buildings to make them more sturdy to be able to withstand some of these quakes. But with some of the older buildings, the brick buildings, you may not be able to do that.
Well, there's plenty of work that can be done on older buildings, and it's a matter of policy and cost. We know how to retrofit unreinforced masonry or brick buildings, or concrete block buildings, for that matter, that aren't reinforced. We also know how to retrofit concrete buildings. We know how to retrofit the wood frame, so-called soft stories, the ones with parking underneath that don't have much structure but are heavy on top. But it's a matter of governments making the choice to require it of building owners or develop a program that offers some compensation. None of that is really, we've just barely touched the tip of the iceberg with that. Many buildings in Los Angeles and San Francisco, brick buildings have been retrofitted, and we have ordinances for some of the soft stories, but there's still a lot more to do and a lot of the rest of California, which has done nothing.
Yeah, and I would say this is an area where we're making good progress in the sense that some cities, including Los Angeles, have passed legislation requiring these retrofits. Now it's just a matter of getting all of that work done. And it just takes a long time to work through this huge inventory.
But is it on the agenda of a lot of the leaders there in California, John, to be able to make these changes in all these areas where really not a whole lot has been done?
Well, it seems to be a mixed bag. So some cities have taken on the challenge and done it, and many have not. So we are seeing movement in this area after so many years without it. So I think in that sense, there's sign for optimism. Certainly when you have a major earthquake like this one that doesn't cause too much damage but reawakens an awareness of earthquake risk, it provides an opportunity for those stragglers to come into the fold and take action.
Mary, I would think that this is not only just an issue for the state to be dealing with, but the local levels as well, the cities and the counties as well.
Well, yes, building codes are ultimately adopted at the local level. So that, I mean, the state, unless the state wants to override all of that and require it, I mean, we do have a state building code for new construction, but we haven't seen state-level retrofit codes as of yet. I'm not sure, you know, what the politics of that are. It's often they want to leave that to the local authorities. And this is a tug of war between, you know, the desire for local governments to keep control over their planning and land use and their regulations, and what some of us might consider a more overarching need to make the state safer and better prepared.
844 Wharton is the number if you would like to join in, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account at DanLoney21. John Stewart from UCLA joining us on the phone along with Mary Comerio from Cal Berkeley. 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. Now, Mary, obviously you have the damage that is acquired or that occurs from the original shock from the earthquake. But obviously there is, I would think, also the issue of the aftershocks as well and any additional damage that may occur from those.
Yes, of course. The earthquake sequence isn't finished until it's finished, until it's calmed down, and there are always potential for reintroduction of further damage on top of whatever might have occurred initially. So a weakened structure might survive the first shock, but might not survive the second one if it's, as in this case, larger than the first.
So
as the Ridge case was.
So John, what has that been like in regards to these specific earthquakes?
Yeah. So in this case, the first, you know, what we now call a foreshock was called a main shock for about a day. The 6.4 earthquake definitely triggered the subsequent 7.1 earthquake. There's absolutely no doubt. Not only because of the timing, but because of the nature of the stress transfer from one fault to another. And we had crews in the field that deployed after the first earthquake and were able to take a look at the impact of that on some pipeline infrastructure, some roadways, and also structures in Trona and some other places. Then we were reoccupying those same sites approximately a day later after the earthquake on July 5th. And you know, there were some substantial changes. That was a case where you go from essentially one main shock to another main shock, and the impact is quite profound. When you're dealing with a more typical situation of a main shock and then much smaller aftershocks, the effects are usually more modest.
You know, John, one of the topics we've talked about here on this show in the past, and it's more dealing with here on the East Coast, is preparedness surrounding hurricanes and the fact that at times people will pull back on their insurance when you go through a stretch where you don't have a lot of significant hurricanes. This had really been, from what I read, the first time in several years where you had these type of significant types of earthquakes. Had there been any kind of development of mindset similar to what I mentioned with hurricanes out there in California, because you went through a significant gap in having these earthquakes?
I think that's just human nature, that when we haven't faced a hazard recently, we tend to, if not forget about it, just sort of put it in the back of our mind and focus on other things. And unfortunately, it's a very self-defeating aspect of human nature when we're dealing with natural hazards like this that we know are there. So there's no doubt with the long gap we've had with a major California urban earthquake, it's decreased awareness.
Mary, your thoughts?
Oh, also, we have, people move to California all the time for jobs in the tech industry and in other businesses. And so we have a lot of new people here who've never experienced an earthquake in the period that they've lived here. And so for them coming from somewhere else, it's not even on their radar screens. So that's also a problem, not only for the Californians who have just forgot about it for a while, but for the new folks who just don't seem to know better.
And I wonder if because, and obviously because these earthquakes were felt in Los Angeles, as was mentioned, Mary. But because of the remoteness of the epicenter of these, is there a concern that you will obviously have the initial concern and obviously the repairs that need to be done? But again, they will be pushed to the side to a degree because of where these were centered.
I think in the popular consciousness, yes, this is not exactly front page news anymore. I mean, it's going to get coverage in the LA Times, but I haven't seen a single article about it up here in Northern California in days since since the last earthquake. So, it's just not the front and center issue that's going to take over the news cycle. And I think that, so it does get some attention. It will certainly get some attention politically in Sacramento, in the state government. It will, it's been, the national emergency has been declared, but it'll be treated as a more routine disaster response that we have for other kinds of storms and floods, smaller, events that aren't urban centered.
John?
The story is a little different in Southern California. It is still front page news on the LA Times every day this week. So, the fact that people experienced it firsthand down here, I think, creates much more of a hunger for information and learning about it. The nature of the stories changes from more science-oriented, what actually happened stories, to more human interest stories, but it still is in the consciousness. I think some of the threads of the conversation here are interesting, that we have this policy that has gone into place in Southern California and some other places to retrofit buildings, while at the same time we had that long gap. And those seem to be inconsistent with each other. And that's actually a case where there were some people who really showed some political leadership in making that happen within that sort of vacuum before we had this earthquake. So I think some credit needs to be given. It's not an easy thing to push through legislation like this when the public isn't necessarily pining for it.
But also, John, the recognition by a lot of these agencies of state government, that companies like Caltrans and others, the recognition that this has to be an important line item in their budgets each and every year.
It's hugely important because we don't get earthquakes every year, but the risk is always there. And the impact of not doing these things is so much greater than the cost of incrementally improving things year after year. We live in an earthquake country, and the effects can be truly devastating. We have to always be vigilant and just try to make things better. And I think in several respects we're doing that, but we have a long way to go.
And going back to something you said a little while ago, John, that's why the importance of the research is just as important today as it was 2 weeks ago before these last earthquakes.
Earthquakes are humbling experiences for us researchers. Sometimes we go out and witness the effects and discover that we seem to have a pretty good handle on things, but more often than not, we're surprised. So we are still at an early stage of understanding the effects of earthquakes, the nature of the ground shaking from earthquakes, how different structures respond. We've come a long way, but we have a long way to go. So this is not esoteric research that's never going to be used. This is research that is essential to advancing public safety.
Mary?
Yeah, I would agree with John completely, obviously. I mean, he and I have been involved in this for most of our careers. So not just in our own self-interest, but really in our care and concern for the whole field and for the improvement of the built environment. And all of us, I think, are heartened by this push for what's called resilience now. And it's really comes from a broader concern than just earthquakes, but for all hazards, that we simply cannot just keep sort of responding, fixing things and putting them back the way they were and then letting them become damaged all over again, whether it's a flood or an earthquake. And so we're really looking at techniques that improve things, in their day-to-day functioning, as well as improve how they behave in a disaster. And I think that's really the cutting edge of the research work.
You had mentioned, Mary, in the course of this interview, some of the more upfront areas of infrastructure, things like the roads and the bridges and pipes and the subway systems. But what are the other areas that maybe the average citizen would not think of that really are being focused on as important parts to this infrastructure build that California needs to do to protect itself?
Well, I think we really need to pay attention to the electrical grid. Obviously, I think it's as important as the water. That's suffered a lot with the damage from wildfires, and we have companies on the brink of bankruptcy. This is a huge issue in California right now, and it's hard to think about earthquake preparedness when they're just trying to survive. But these things are critical, as well as the interoperability of these different infrastructure systems. I mean, you can't, how do they restore order after an event? How quickly can they get things back up and running? It isn't just what one utility is going to do and another one has their own thing. They need to coordinate. And that degree of interoperability is something that hasn't had enough work done on it and needs much more work so that they are better coordinated and better organized.
John?
Yeah, to that list, I would add our ports. So California is a huge importer of goods through the ports of Oakland, Long Beach, Los Angeles. And these ports, like much of coastal California, are right next to active faults. They're also, of course, next to the sea with high groundwater. That makes the soils liquefiable. And the ports are a resource that is desperately needed after an earthquake. Of course, they're needed all the time, but in the aftermath of a major earthquake, you need to get goods in. You need to get folks in to help restore things. And these are vulnerable nodal points. And so we really have to be paying attention to hardening our ports.
Well, the ports themselves, John, as you kind of alluded to, the importance that some of those ports have in California for getting goods from places like China on a daily, monthly basis is an incredibly important piece to the U.S. economy.
Yeah, the economy of the entire nation. It's not just California, obviously. And, the fact is that there's a lot of liquefiable soils within these ports. And we've seen ports go down all over the world when they're strongly shaken by earthquakes. Getting them, it's one of those things where you really need them to be operable as soon as possible after the earthquake. It's not a matter of avoiding a catastrophic failure of the port. Of course, you want to do that too, but you need it to be usable as soon as possible. And this gets into something we call performance-based engineering related to the resilience that Mary was talking about.
Well, John, one of the areas that I think is not talked about as much within the state of California is the oil and gas industry. And that's an important economic component in that state as well. And when you think about those specific pieces to the California economy, the preparedness that you need to have with those companies as well.
Yeah, we have major natural gas providers here, oil and gas industry. We have pipelines carrying natural gas and oil crossing faults, crossing liquefiable areas, often not very far removed from other critical infrastructure like electrical grids, highways, rail networks. So it's quite a combination of critical infrastructure in some parts of the state with huge natural hazards.
Mary, not that you want to see all of these different events continuing to happen, but the fact that the mindset has changed, I think, in California, and I guess to a degree it's really been there for a while because of all of the past earthquakes, but when you have something like the wildfires that the state went through recently, and then on top of this you have these quakes, the mindset is really geared into understanding that there are a variety of different issues and problems that will continually be in play in the state of California.
Yes, that's true. And I hope that, maybe we see a little bit more political attention to this. Unfortunately, I think we also have some other really huge problems in California that have to do with affordable housing and housing in availability in general. And so that kind of an issue has kind of overshadowed other sort of statewide issues, and as a result hasn't, you know, the disaster side hasn't got as much attention, and perhaps this combination will give it a little more highlighting and a little more attention, but you never are sure. We want to be prepared to be able to help if there is political interest, and we want to be ready, but it's hard to do it without the politicians being willing to engage.
John, your thoughts?
Yeah, and, you know, politicians are a mixed bag. We've had those who tend to overlook it, and we've had those who have been willing to engage. You know, so I would give some credit to Mayor Garcetti in that regard. You know, he's actually been criticized a fair bit on the homeless question here in Southern California, but he was, you know, a pioneer in really pushing through some legislation to improve earthquake safety. You know, so as Mary said, they have a lot on their plate, a lot to deal with. We need to make sure that they are aware and presented with evidence of the risk that we have from our natural hazards, so that that's always part of the mix that they're considering in their crafting of policy.
And I wonder, I guess, John, it's not even a situation where you can prioritize one over the other, or is it?
Well, clearly, these are all issues that need to be addressed. The question is often, given the limited resources, how are you going to approach it, and how can we make the process as efficient as possible? If we're putting up a lot of regulatory barriers to construction, for example, well, then that slows down the process of retrofitting buildings and doesn't help seismic safety. You know, it also doesn't help the construction of housing for homeless folks. So, you know, I think all these things are there, and they're not completely independent, and it's just a matter of trying to make this as efficient as possible.
Great having you both with us. Thank you for your insight, John. Mary, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Jonathan Stewart at UCLA, professor of civil and environmental engineering. Mary Camario, who is a professor of the graduate school at Cal Berkeley in the Department of Architecture. We will take a break. Our final 30 coming up in just a minute. After the break, we're going to be joined by contributor to the Wall Street Journal magazine, Christina Binkley, who covers quite a bit of the fashion industry, to talk about some of the issues surrounding Kim Kardashian lately, the shapewear line that she wanted to bring out, and obviously some of the problems surrounding the naming of that line being kimono, and the reaction by many people in the Japanese community to branding that clothing line using that particular item, which has such an important piece, an important linkage to the Japanese culture. We'll do that next. Sirius XM 132 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.